Welcome to Blightbringers, a Legion of Everblight-focused War Machine and Hordes podcast. I'm your host, Ronlor, a.k.a. Tyrone, Child of the Dragon. Joining me this week is Wolf, Raven of War.
I'd just like to say I had no choice on the theme I was given.
Also here this week is Cutter, Primal Terror.
Oh, yeah, I can work with that one. I actually just played Primal Terrors 100% in my last tournament, so I'm good to go with that.
Right on. Finally, special guest this week, Privateer Press Staff and Oracle of Annihilation, Doug Seacat. Doug, welcome to the show.
Hello, glad to be here.
Oh, the puns.
Yeah, this is Doug Seacat. I guess my title right now is Senior Writer in Continuity at Privateer Press, and kind of in charge of keeping straight all the nonsense that we write up and try to make sense of it when it doesn't seem like it should.
Awesome.
We do enjoy nonsense.
And so with Legion in particular, I've done a lot of the writing of the fiction, not all of it. There's definitely been other writers involved, but I've done quite a bit of the story fiction.
Right on. Well, we thank you for that because It's been amazing.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, so moving into the topic, so as kind of a background, we did sample from the Legion community. We, through our Facebook page, through the Discord chat, kind of gathered some questions and tried to organize them into some broad topics to speak on. So we'll kind of go through those, and I guess as an outline, it's going to be kind of a background introduction to Legion for some of the unenlightened, and then talking about Athanx and some of the magic that kind of goes into the Legion of Everblight. We'll move into Ethryn Ball's laboratory, talking about the evolution of Legion beasts, maybe talk a little bit about Dragonspawn and some of their unique elements, and also how the Blight has affected different races. And then, time permitting, we'll get into some other things like the creative process and some fan questions.
Sounds good.
Awesome. So starting off, do you want to kind of give us a taste of Legion's backstory, kind of where it is, kind of the cliff notes of where the Legion of Everblight comes from? And I know some of our newer players haven't gotten through all the backstory.
Sure. Yeah, I'll try to summarize. I mean, it's definitely one of those things that's sometimes a little hard to figure out how to shorten it the best. You know, the Legion's a little weird in that it's within the world, kind of our newest faction. It as a faction with an army, it's only been around for a few years. But the dragon, Everblight, that kind of is behind it all, is an entity that's been around for a really long time, for centuries. And one of the ideas with our setting is that dragons are these extremely powerful kind of alien beings. All of our dragons originate from the Dragon Father, which is Torek, who's the head of the Crixian faction. And the idea is that he created a bunch of spawn, you know, centuries ago or thousands of years ago, and each of those became a dragon. And Everblight is one of Torek's spawn. And the dragons had this problem where, you know, Torek created the dragons hoping they would be his friends and servants and slaves, and each of them was as arrogant and full of themselves as he was, and so they immediately rebelled. And so we created strife between the dragons in this way. So the dragons don't get along. They would eat Torek if they could. We had most of the dragons set up sort of an alliance, but Everblight kind of stayed out of that. And in time, sort of kind of had his own thing going on. And I feel like it's easy to get into the weeds a little bit on this. But the idea with Everblight is that he managed to kind of be a little bit sneakier. He's smarter. He had an interest in controlling his own blight and kind of conducted these experiments over the centuries to sort of deliberately create dragon spawn and to kind of alter other beings in ways that the other dragons hadn't. And part of that comes from his need to sort of survive and do his own thing. Plus he sort of has, he's a little bit more active than the other dragons. He's a little bit less patient. And one of the things that he kind of became interested in was sort of biological engineering. And he discovered that the elves in particular seemed to be vulnerable to his tricks, to his blight manipulations. And so we had this time period where he was still, you know, a dragon out in the world, and he snuck under Ios and was kind of experimenting on the elves in secret, like from caves below one of their forgotten fanes. And he was making, you know, blighted minions And one of them got loose, you know, left the lab, wandered up into the city, and everybody freaked out, realized there was a dragon, and that was below the city of Asira. And Everblight's, he was sort of forced into the open when they sent soldiers down to kind of root him out. And in this fight, the city of Asira got destroyed, but so did Everblight's body. And so we kind of have this first big setback for Everblight where he was basically defeated. And even though he took out a bunch of the elves, you know, with him, and he was reduced to his Aathank. And one of the concepts with our dragons is that there's this sort of unbreakable, imperishable crystal at the center of every dragon, which is something called an Aathank. And if the Aathank can basically reform the dragon's body around it, but that can take time, and you know that, and the dragons can't do that, you know, instantly. And so when Everblight was reduced to his Aathank, when his body was destroyed, the elves knew that they had to do something about that, and they sealed away his Aathank and sent it somewhere remote, hoping to kind of seal it away forever. And where they put it happened to be near the homeland of the Nis, and the box they put Everblight in maybe wasn't quite as good as they hoped it would be. And he was able to kind of reach out from beyond the containment and was able to seize hold of initially Thagrosh, an Ogryn that was kind of fleeing for his life in the area. And basically Thagrosh freed Everblight, and that's kind of the start of the Legion. Is Everblight knew that the Nis were nearby and that their makeup was similar to the elves that he had experimented on before. And he found a way to basically sort of corrupt and take them over with his blight through using Thagrosh. And, you know, there's some other parts of that story we can get into later involving Vale. But the whole notion is the seed of the Legion comes from Everblight having been defeated once and then deciding that he was going to go about things a little bit differently the next time. And he decided that he was going to stay bodiless. Like he was going to use his knowledge of his own self to instead divide the pieces of himself and give them to his sort of chosen generals. And this is where the warlocks of the Legion come from, is each one of these warlocks has a piece of Everblight inside them and is able to create the dragon spawn that Everblight would normally create if he was a full dragon. And in staying sort of disembodied, he's become more powerful in some ways because he doesn't have the limitations of a single body or a single perspective. And so that's kind of the Legion, is this sort of this linked consciousness between Everblight's chosen generals and the dragon that's kind of inside each of their heads.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit about that experience, I guess, of
Sure. What,
you know, when you have a shard kind of stuck in your bloodstream, because my understanding is that it's part of that system, right? The blood.
Yeah, we've tended to kind of imply that it's usually kind of crammed somewhere into the heart, without actually breaking it, I guess, or you know, the heart maybe sort of reforms around it, and so then the Aathank is basically allowing the warlock to have dragon blood because their blood is passing over, you know, the Aathank.
Okay, and then I know it merges with the consciousness. We were kind of interested about what, if you could say a little bit about how the experience of a warlock might play out once you get this shard.
Sure.
Consciousness perspective, yeah.
It's definitely, it's a little confusing, it's a little varied, but the idea is, you know, we talk a little bit about what it's like for warlocks to be able to control and use the senses of their war beasts. I've always thought of it as being kind of similar for Everblight, where it's like he's able to sort of monitor and control his warlocks in the similar way that his warlocks can control war beasts. And so the idea is that each of these characters has their own mind, their own consciousness, their own thoughts, but Everblight's always sort of connected to them. He's always there. But his active sort of consciousness, what he's paying attention to, isn't always the same. So there are times where a warlock might be, you know, basically, you know, you can imagine as being in the background of Everblight's mind. Like, you know, he's not paying attention to, you know, let's say Vale in a given moment. Like Vale's just sort of doing her own thing. If he needs to, he can kind of inhabit her mind. He can look through her eyes, but maybe he's preoccupied with something else, with his own thoughts or something going on elsewhere. So he might just sort of, you know, you can imagine it like he's sort of filtering out any information that might come from her. And so there's this sort of variable level of connection between Everblight and the Warlocks, where sometimes like the Warlocks will feel like Everblight's right there with them. And you know, he can literally sort of take over their whole being if he wants to, but that's rare. Like usually that would be maybe something really important is going on, or there's a battle that's going poorly, or, you know, there's certain circumstances where that kind of act of control happens. But in other cases, he might be distant and remote, and maybe you just get an order from him, you know, go do this, go do that. and they're still drawing on his power. He's still empowering their magic and their ability to create spawn, but he's not necessarily equally with, you know, every Warlock at a given moment. And similarly, like he can kind of, if he wants to, he can sort of tune them out. Like he, you know, they aren't guaranteed to be able to talk to Everblight if he doesn't want to listen to them at a given moment. And similarly, they can talk to each other through this kind of shared mental network. So it gives the Legion Warlocks this pretty amazing communication facility that pretty much no other faction has in quite this degree, where, you know, when everything's going smoothly, they can be communicating with each other telepathically basically all the time. And they also have access to a lot of Everblight's knowledge as a dragon. His mind is huge and vast, and he's been around for thousands of years. And we've kind of depicted in the fiction that, like, when Thagrosh first picked up the Authink, like, it really changed him. Like, you know, it's not that he was an idiot or anything before, but he was a simple, you know, ogre, and he was a slave. His worldview was really narrow. And, you know, then suddenly he was joined to this vast dragon mind. You know, and we've shown that Everblight speaks, you know, all kinds of different languages. He's able to, you know, instantly understand all sorts of things. He has these memories that stretch back into the depths of time. And sometimes the Warlocks can access that. It's like they can kind of reach into Everblight's memories if, you know, if he allows it, and kind of know certain things. And we've used that to facilitate, you know, like communication with other factions. Like a lot of the Nis probably wouldn't be able to speak most of the languages of the other factions, except Everblight knows them. And so they can kind of draw on that.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, I was going to say, so it kind of sounds like the Warlocks are to Everblight what the Spawn are to the Warlocks.
Yeah, I would say that, except that, you know, there's definitely, their sense they're all, you know, individual characters that are very intelligent in their own right. You know, Everblight clearly gets something out of that as well, whereas a lot of the times the Dragon Spawn are kind of shown as being not exactly mindless, but they're not. Most of the Dragon Spawn don't have very complex minds. You know, they're kind of almost like living weapons that are created to serve Everblight and the Warlocks. And so it feels like the communication's probably a lot more one way with the Warlocks to the Warbeasts, whereas, you know, the Warlock to Everblight, it's a little bit more nuanced.
Yeah, getting the thoughts of a Carnivian into your consciousness does sound kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I imagine it's a lot of eat this.
Yeah, I was imagining the Shredders, you know, they're just basically just little hunger pangs all the time, you know, as they want to get bigger.
You look at them, you just see how delicious they look.
Just legs with teeth.
Hey, Shredder, how are you feeling? Hungry. Oh, hungry. You were hungry yesterday. Still hungry. Well, this was fun.
Yeah, there's no complex conversations happening with the Dragon Spawn for the most part. Although, you know, one thing that we haven't had a chance to get into too much, and I think is something we'll probably get into a little bit more in the conversation, is the Nephilim are a little different because they're unusual. And so among the Dragon Spawn, the Nephilim do have minds in theory. And so there could be more of a communication happening there, which is, like I said, I don't think we've had a chance to explore it a lot in the fiction. We've seen that. We've seen a little bit of it. But the Nephilim are really interesting since they're less simple.
Yeah, I remember reading in some of the fluff a while back that it was Zuriel and Ryas in particular. Like, if you found one of them, you typically found them sparring together. And that was
right.
Like a thing that they were constantly doing and, like, trying to one-up each other. And I feel like that's the thing you'd have with, like, a typical beast, because it's not going to care. It's just going to eat the thing. And if it can't eat the thing, it's going to die trying.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that's kind of fun, just looking across sort of the spectrum of hordes in general, is we see a variety of sort of ranges of intelligence among the various war beasts. And I think in the Legion, like, your default war beast is among the least intelligent, and which, you know, they sort of have the least personality, a lot of the regular Legion dragon spawn, because like I said, they're basically sort of like engineered weapons. And so a lot of the, you can imagine Everblight as this sort of alien you know, biologist who's he doesn't want to build in some of the limitations that normal living creatures have that would kind of get in the way of what he needs them for. And so in some ways they're simple, but that also makes them extra scary because, like, they do get hungry, but they don't actually have to eat. They don't have the same kind of survival instincts. And so basically it's like some of those instincts that could overwhelm a normal animal won't happen to a Legion war beast. And so he kind of was able to pick and choose what he wanted in terms of their psychology. But then again, like, we do have the Nephilim, which are born of Nis and are sort of a hybrid of Nis and dragon spawn. And so it kind of has some of the qualities of both. And I've always imagined them as being, again, somewhat alien. Like they're not just like a Nis that happens to have claws. You know, they would definitely share a number of those dragon spawn traits, but they do have a more advanced mind and they do have some self-will. They're able to sometimes do things, you know, without being told. It's almost like their own sort of beginnings of a culture among the Nephilim that's sort of distinct. And the closest parallel would be maybe like the Warp Wolves in the Circle Ouroboros, which are also, some of them are intelligent, but they're not just like people. They're definitely like a wild animal that has its own instincts, its own cravings, you know, the certain like ferocity and kind of predatory outlook on the world. And I think the Nephilim are kind of similar, where they're smarter, but they're not the same as like Nis.
Yeah. So there are a couple of related questions that I know had some interest around them. And maybe you can speak to them. And they're all kind of about the passage of time in respect to dragon spawn. One point is when Everblight consumed Pyromalphix, Athank.
Yes.
That kind of merged. And I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Sure.
What that did a little bit, and also how that might affect what Everblight was up to in terms of beast development and engineering.
Sure.
And if it, you know, affects consciousness and like kind of how that merging might work.
Yeah. So the Authanks are a real fun concept, just as, like I said, there's a certain way that you can consider the Authank to be the dragon, which is just basically this like crystal. And so, you know, it all goes back to Torek, who, you know, at one point was the only dragon and had, you know, the Authank. And so he divided his Authank into different pieces, which became these other dragons. But the Authanks are this sort of insanely powerful, you know, sort of infinite energy thing. You know, they're like these sentient crystals that just generate this tremendous blighted energy and are almost impossible to destroy. The only way that we've shown that Authanks can be changed or affected is basically dragons interacting with one another. So, you know, Torek was able to divide his Authank, but remained who he was. So he was able to, but maybe he sort of invested some of his power into these minor versions of himself. And when he realized that was a mistake, when they kind of rebelled against him, he decided he needed to get them all back. And so we had this dragon war, this sort of long-standing dragon war that's been happening, where Torek, you know, would individually hunt down his progeny and eat them wherever he could find them, and sort of rejoining that essence of himself back, you know, to his original state. And so there's this sort of division and merging that can happen with the Authanks that are otherwise kind of impossible to destroy. And there's been a similar thing that happened with Everblight, where we mentioned that because of the danger of Torek, the Dragon Father, most of the other dragons kind of entered into an alliance with one another, even though they didn't necessarily have any reason to like one another. In other circumstances, they might be fighting amongst one another, sort of Highlander style, to try to see, you know, who would be the ultimate victor. But they realized that if they were to fight among themselves, Torek would be the one who would ultimately win. And so instead, they banded together to sort of keep a watch on Torek. But Everblight became this sort of, you know, wild card that was outside of that agreement. And for a while, didn't matter because he was imprisoned in this box and was sort of forgotten as this defeated dragon. That, you know, at one point, there was even probably the possibility among the dragons, they might have thought that Torek had already eaten him. But when he emerged, he's in this sort of uniquely vulnerable but also interesting position of having created this army, but knowing that his status could be in peril either to the other dragons, or one of the ways that he could make himself more powerful would be if he could find another dragon and eat their Authank, basically sort of you know, that we could, you could imagine where each of the Authanks could be like different in size and or in power. And, you know, so it's not exactly like he would be doubling his power, but maybe doubling, maybe tripling. You know, we've never quite explained exactly how it works. But the idea is if any dragon eats another dragon, they become much more powerful. And so we had that come to pass early in the Legion storyline in Mark 1, where through some complex shenanigans with Gorshade, Gorshade let them know, he let Thagrosh know where a vulnerable dragon was for his own purposes. And so Everblight gathered the Legion and took the risk of, you know, crossing sort of vast distance quickly, gathering all of his forces, and moving to the Castle of the Keys, where Pyromalphic was laired, and Pyromalphic had been in sort of an injured state and kind of having some difficulties. He had his own sort of cult that was sort of watching over him. But that area had also kind of become inhabited by other forces. There was like a Scorn fortress in the nearby region. But the Legion basically moved in there, took the risk, lost, you know, a large chunk of their army at the time, but was able to defeat Pyromalphic. And Thagrosh, serving as sort of a proxy for Everblight's physical form, was able to consume Pyromalphic's Authank. And so we had that as part of the Mark 1 storyline, was Thagrosh having to sort of take on this task of absorbing this other dragon's Authank and becoming stronger and more powerful and kind of distributing that power out to the other warlocks. And it was in that time frame that, for example, like Typhon got spawned, where from like a small piece of Typhon's one of the only dragon spawn that has a small piece of an Authank in him. And that kind of happened during that fusing period. And we've kind of explored the notion that Everblight's own mind expanded, and, you know, maybe he came up with some new ideas for Dragonspawn and for how he could manipulate the Nis, you know, from that fusing. But it was a difficult process. Like, it wasn't easy, especially because he wasn't a dragon anymore and he didn't have all of his power kind of in one place. So, you know, we kind of use that as a period when Everblight was vulnerable, but managed to, through the end of it, become more powerful.
Okay, I was going to say, so then I guess my question is, when you absorb an Athank, does that change the personality, or like, does that change the dragon who initially like ate it? So in the case of Everblight taking on Pyromalefic, like, did that change him as a quote unquote person?
He would probably say no, but I think that I think the chances are that it, I think that sort of how, you know, we've kept some of this stuff a little bit mysterious, where, you know, there's not exact rules on how this all goes down, but you kind of get the sense, at least from how the dragons approach this war, that the expectation is that the victor in one of these dragon fights would probably be the one whose personality wins out. And once the other dragon is, you know, physically defeated, you know, maybe that also weakens their mind enough to where they are eventually absorbed and sort of subsumed into the mind of the other dragon. But you do have to wonder, like, you know, how complex is that crystalline structure? You know, the mind within, you would have to think it has to be affected by sort of these changes in its mass and nature. And so I do think that there's a very high likelihood that Everblight's mind changed in that process. And we've, you know, there was kind of some hints there that it could even be that the whatever had weakened Pyromalphic was causing Everblight some difficulties during that sort of absorption process. And I think that it did probably change it. But it's not like, it wouldn't be as simple as, like, you know, there being a piece. It's not like Pyromalphic still exists. It's just that now there's Everblight, who is slightly different, maybe. You know, you could see it as maybe the only way that the dragons can have a character arc is to eat another dragon.
Okay.
Yeah. For Everblight, you've been referring to Everblight with a masculine pronoun. Is that just to make it easier to talk about, or did the dragons actually have identifiable genders in some capacity? That was something that had come up.
It's a good question. As far as I'm concerned, they do not a gender identity. So in some cases, it's sort of a convenience of language thing. I do think, you know, there's at least one or two of the dragons that I think we've used female pronouns for before, but that isn't reflective of anything to do with their biology or any kind of how they would identify themselves. It could be that you could kind of consider it almost to be more of a structure of those who are interacting with the dragon, attributing to it like a male gender, even though it's not really there. But okay. the dragons are basically sexless.
Yeah, okay. So it's like how people would refer to an archangel as a female or an Angelus right. as a female, and maybe like a rake as a male or something like that. We just kind of project onto them.
Yeah, and similarly, like dragon spawn don't have gender because they don't really reproduce sexually. So it's mostly just sort of a language convenience, but you could also imagine it as potentially a personality thing. But I think if it's anything with Everblight, it would just be reflective of that merging with Faagrosh, that initial, you know, merging with Faagrosh. It's possible that, you know, there's kind of a weird line that we've had some fun exploring in the fiction between like the divide between Faagrosh and Everblight, because sometimes they get confused about, yeah. you know, where the line between them is. And I think Faagrosh in particular struggles with that. Like that was something that we explored, especially the, you know, with his epic transformation, is like, there's times where he, you know, it feels like he's losing himself into the dragon, but there's also this struggle to still exist, to not just be a single entity. But again, it's possible that Faagrosh's nature could have had an impact on sort of Everblight's day-to-day, how he presents himself or some of his patterns of thought, because the largest single cohesive piece of his offense is in Faagrosh.
That's kind of cool. So just going back a little bit, you said at the Castle of the Keys, Pyromalefic had kind of his own cult.
Yeah.
His own, not quite legion, but like his own like watchers. Is that like a typical thing for dragons to have? Like, hey, here's a couple humans or elves or dwarves or whoever that happened to come by. I'm going to take control of them so they can like keep a lookout for me so I don't have to be out in the open.
Yeah, it's something we've explored a little bit. I think it's probably very individual to dragon. I think most of the dragons actually like interacting closely with mortals, which they consider to be sort of lesser beings. So I think most of the dragons don't have many mortal followers. We've kind of shown them as being sort of aloof and isolated beings for the most part. But I do think that we've shown that several might find it useful to maybe take a couple, or like we've shown with Blightergast has, you know, like we've shown like sort of an emissary that he was able to create, you know, from some kind of a blighted mortal that could go interact with other mortals. And so I think each dragon probably has his own sort of way of going about it. And with Pyromalefic, there was definitely an actual cult of elves. And it appears that it was one of the things we kind of got into in some of the fiction, one of which I think we are going to reprint in my little short story anthology. But there's a suggestion that there were some members from House Vir, Gorshade's house, that had actually kind of decided to worship the dragon and had kind of, you know, formed some kind of outside of some little cult outside of Ios that was doing some weird necromantic stuff, you know, down in his lair. So yeah, I think it's like I said, it's highly individualized. It doesn't seem that the dragons normally go so far as what Everblight has done. And I think that a lot of that came from what happened when he was defeated and kind of, you know, him getting the idea that he needed to completely change his approach. So Everblight's the first dragon that we've shown that's really, other than Torak himself, it's created an army. And even with Torak, you know, you can see that also was kind of rooted in that, you know, that's something that maybe didn't occur to him until the other dragons drove him from the mainland. And then he decided that perhaps it would be useful to create an empire in order to have some assets to use against his progeny. So it doesn't seem to be sort of a natural thought process with the dragons, but we've shown at least with Torak and Everblight this gathering an army and you know, putting them to work.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit on the effect of the blight, whether intentional or incidental, on some of the model subtypes that we see in the Legion of Everblight. So like the Nyss, Ogryn, Striders, we see Grotusks, we see some other weird stuff showing up, like
sure.
Hellmouths and Thrones, and you know, there's some weird kind of things going on.
Some real weird stuff.
Yeah, and Succubi in particular were something that one of the fans was interested in.
Sure. Well, it's definitely something that's kind of expanded. Like one of the very first and simplest effects of the blight that we see with Everblight kind of goes back to that beginning of the Legion, where basically that's something I'm actually going to be doing, exploring in some fiction that's coming up soon. I'm going to have a chance to show this, the sort of the meeting between Vale and Faagrosh in those earliest cool. of days. But Vale basically offered to help Everblight by betraying her own people. And I've imagined that Thagros was initially probably going to do much more of a brutal takeover of the Nis, maybe enslaving them and subjecting them to the Blight in a sort of more of a overt way. But Vale offered a means to get the dragon blood into their water supply. And so sort of that first subtlest effect of the Blight that we've shown is even in very small quantities, it can make these changes in the Nis that made them loyal to Everblight. And it wasn't that it affected everybody, but there was some percentage of the population that basically immediately developed a really strong compulsive loyalty to Everblight that drove them so far that they would kill, you know, their neighbors or, you know, maybe even family members. And so you almost have this sort of like zombie apocalypse kind of situation with the Nis where, you know, in a very short period of time, like a certain portion of the population just suddenly turned on itself and decided that they would serve Everblight rather than the god that they've been worshiping for since time immemorial. So that's kind of one of the subtle but really important parts of the Blight is this sort of loyalty to Everblight. And then we've sort of shown that as part of his experimentation with the elves that Everblight has a great deal of control over the elves in particular. It's like he can do more with them. It's easier for him to shape their forms because of sort of this research that he had done, plus whatever vulnerability that they had, maybe from the fact that, you know, their gods were suffering. So we've shown him kind of taking them and in further and further from what they originally were. You know, like early forms of that would be something like the Strider, which looks physically different in certain ways, kind of has slightly more of a modified body type to enable them to run more quickly and that kind of thing. It kind of augments their predatory nature. We have things like the Grotesques that are, like, you can barely tell it's a Nis at all. And so we've kind of been showing that Everblight has been, I just can't help but think of it as like his main hobby is sort of experimenting on these body types. Like he's just endlessly interested in what he can create. And I just imagine him trying to push the limits and seeing what he can make. And there's something in it that I think is actually really interesting. That's just beyond, it's, you know, in theory, all these things are weapons, but he already had weapons. And so I think there's definitely a sort of a desire to create something new and different, you know, and horrible. The throne is I think a good example of something. It's like, you know, why do you need that? Why do you need a thing that's walking around on tentacles and tongues? And, you know, I just think it's something going on in Everblight's head where he's like, that thing is really cool.
I agree.
But yeah, clearly, like recently he seemed to get into tentacles a bit, you know, with a couple of different things. But yeah, I just imagine him being like, you could say insane, but just alien, like where he's always got new ideas. Like he's always got something else he wants to try. And, you know, it's like he's never entirely satisfied with the forms that he has created. You know, some of the dragon spawn that we have in the Legion, we've talked about the fact that those go back to way earlier times with the one of our first sort of dark human civilizations is Mord, which was sort of an early necromantic kingdom kind of in the Thornwood area. And Everblight was lairing under that kingdom for a while and was kind of loaning his dragon spawn to the lords of Mord to terrify their neighbors. And so some of the dragon spawn that he's still using now are rooted in, you know, forms that he originally created back when he was kind of helping the kingdom of Mord and sort of, you know, taking that over before Torek kind of found out where he was and drove him off. So you do have these forms that are much older that he still seems to like, but then he's making these new things. And, you know, with the gargantuans being one of the most exciting of his new forms that he's been playing with.
Yeah, so it's kind of an alien brilliance in this creation that looks very similar to madness, maybe to mortal.
And I think it's madness, but, you know, with internally it's a genius, of course. And Everblight's convinced he is the smartest and, you know, ultimately most powerful dragon. It's a matter of debate among the dragons, of course. But you brought up the succubi. They're offshoot. We have a few things like the Forsaken, where there's times where the Blight is so powerful that it causes these almost like unpredictable transformations. And I think the succubi was probably sort of an offshoot of that. It's like you have the Forsaken, which wasn't planned as much as some of the other ones, but was useful. It's a useful sort of super blighted form. And that might have led to how can I create something a little bit more deliberate and useful? And one of the things that I think some of that explorations allowed were things like the shepherd, where you create, you have a blightedness who doesn't have an authentic, but whose blight is channeled in such a way that they are able to kind of feel that harmony with the dragon spawn. It's almost like they aren't able to do the exact same thing as what a warlock does, but it's kind of related. They're able to kind of reach out to the minds of dragon spawn and interact with them in a way that normally only the warlocks can do.
Okay. Yeah, that does answer one of the questions we were going to ask about shepherds and Forsaken and how they kind of work with the dragon spawn. And I know that there's some similarity between the Forsaken and Absalonia.
Yes.
And that was something that someone wanted to have talked about a little bit, was they're particularly fond of Absalonia. And I think
she's really interesting.
Kind of a reawakening recently too with the CID release, if there's anything you wanted to say about her.
Well, I think she's really interesting because, you know, like we said, that most of the characters still have sort of a distinct personality. You know, in most cases, it's rooted in what they were before. But Absalonia is somebody who, it's almost like her past was erased. You know, she'd be considered, I guess if you could think of like the Forsaken as an extremely blighted version of a blightedness, you know, Absalonia is almost like an extreme form of a warlock who has so embraced the change and their sort of the blighted energy that they're at peace and at one with sort of their transformed state. Like, you know, some of the other NIS, like it's interesting for me to think about, like, Vale is somebody who looks very similar to her NIS form. Like, she doesn't have as many outward signs of the blight. And I think that's probably because she's, you know, stubborn. She's, you know, there's a really strong sense of from Vale. She's very confident in who she is, even though she joined herself to Everblight and has, you know, she's fully committed to what he's doing. She sees herself as herself. And Absalonia has more embraced sort of this like unity with Everblight where you can see it almost as like an extreme form of zealotry or something. That's almost like in the religion of Everblight, Absalonia has kind of given herself over to be transformed. And we kind of explored the idea of her sort of mutable form, you know, when she became epic, where, you know, she kind of became more draconic. And so, you know, some people in the Legion could consider her initial form to be somewhat horrific or something because it was so different from the Nis, whereas she would see it as something perfected. And so she, like I said, kind of embraced that draconic side of herself in a way that's different from some of the other warlocks. You know, I think she's a really interesting character, you know, in a similar but different way as Kallus, which we can get into a little bit. But with Absalonia, it's almost like a Tabula Rasa or something where she's, it's almost like her life began when she became a warlock as far as she's concerned. You know, she did have a past, but she's kind of put that aside. And so she's still intelligent. She still has, you know, a mind, but she's become... It feels very natural for her to allow Everblight to inhabit her. And so she's, you know, I wouldn't say she's an empty vessel, but she's willing to kind of channel the dragon in a way that some of the other warlocks would probably feel uncomfortable with.
Yeah, and that kind of makes sense why she would be kind of so strongly associated with beasts in the faction.
Yeah. Yeah, and we kind of set it up to where, like, you know, you can imagine the Blight is basically an energy form. And it's kind of the basic energy that all of the warlocks and the dragons call upon. And I just imagine that energy flowing through Absalonia a lot more easily and in a different way that seems to make it like, you know, we've kind of always explored her having sort of healing powers with the beasts. And I just kind of imagine her as sort of this font of blighted energy that can connect to the beasts and empower them. And we've also talked about her having a particular affinity for spawning beasts. Like, she's able to spawn them more quickly. Maybe, you know, it's not as tiring for her. It's like, you know, her blood regenerates more quickly. So she sort of is this sort of like font of creation with the dragon spawn.
Yeah, that's really cool. One of the things that I think some people were interested in is the different races that mm-hmm. have been, or different species that have been kind of affected by the blight and maybe some of them reject it or just melt into a puddle? Or, you know, like, do we have like blighted squirrels running around?
I like to think so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's blighted squirrels.
Well, we have what are they called? The birds there now, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
yeah, the rot wings are great.
And they became blighted because they were eating blighted flesh, was my understanding.
Yeah, that's correct. And yeah, and the Ogryn are definitely, you know, it was one of the fun aspects of the Legion that, you know, we were able to explore more, you know, with the Ogryn theme force. But the idea of there being the blight being different when it does affect these different races. And you know, the Ogryn is sort of almost like a secondary population within the Legion. Like, he, Everblight had not studied the Ogryn, and they didn't have the same kind of vulnerabilities to the blight that makes them as easy to change as the Nis or other elves, but they're still useful. You know, we kind of embrace the idea that with the Ogryn, the blight brings this sort of unique form of madness that's still useful to Everblight because it makes them into these sort of berserker warriors. And it's a type of madness that can be channeled and controlled, you know, by the warlocks. And you know, it's almost like it's that same sort of zealotry where their loyalty to Everblight means that even though they're crazy, they're still doing what they're told to do by Everblight's chosen, you know, generals.
As long as they listen and kill things.
But they definitely don't like each other. I always imagine there being some segregation, you know, where the Nis and the Ogryn, you know, they'll fight together and stuff, but they aren't entirely comfortable with one another. And, you know, in my mind, there probably are other blighted races that could be in the Legion, but some of that comes down to aesthetics choices. Like, you know, we probably wouldn't want to blur the lines too much by broadening, you know, the Legion soldiery out to a bunch of different types of races. But like in my opinion, you know, there's no inherent reason why there couldn't be blighted humans that Everblight has taken over, and maybe, you know, they would have a different kind of quality or a different trait that we would see in them. And that's something we've even, you know, we haven't had a chance to do it, but it's something we've talked about occasionally as being something we could explore in the fiction. But again, when it comes down to like the army aesthetics, some of that comes down to the choices that we want to make. And I don't think there's necessarily like free reign. Like, I do think there could be some creatures that would be like, it's not like Everblight couldn't affect them, but it might just not be as useful to wholesale bring them in. Like, I definitely imagine like rural folk as being somewhat resistant. We had a chance to show some blighted dwarves after sort of the big dragon war stuff, where one of the dragons like crashed into a dwarven enclave in Signar. And so, you know, the dwarves can definitely be affected and have their minds changed, but it might be in a way that you know, they don't necessarily become good Legion soldiers, you know, from that. Yeah. So it might not be something that Everblight has sought out. And it's, you know, so maybe Everblight would rather just collect up a bunch of dead dwarves and put them in pots and turn them into dragon spawn.
I mean, it's pragmatic.
Yeah.
And we did show this for a dwarf.
Yeah, exactly. And we show that happening a little bit in Southern Rule, you know, when right around the time of Thagrosh's transformation is, you know, they kind of cropped up in Southern Rule and immediately, you know, wiped out a couple of dwarven mines and some small towns on the fringes of Rule that then basically got turned into meat for spawning cauldrons.
Yeah, so you were talking a little bit about maintaining the faction's aesthetic, or like its essence in a way. And I was wondering, along with talking on the creative process a little bit from your perspective, what would you say is kind of the faction's essence? Like, what defines it from other factions? And then how does that play into the creative process for Legion models and Legion background? Kind of like where your place is and how you see that perspective?
Well, there's definitely, you know, several sides of that, because there's sort of the gameplay essence, which isn't something I'm as much involved with. And I think there's a visual aesthetic that was initially created by, you know, by Matt Wilson, and that he's wanted to both adhere to but then explore in new and different ways. On my side, I think of the Legion as, even though Krix is ruled by a dragon, I think of Krix as being more of an undead and pirate, you know, sort of evil pirate faction. And so the Legion of Everblight, I really feel as being that dragon aesthetic kind of crosses all things. We have the dragon spawn, we have you know, these dragon like gargantuans, we have the blight showing up even on the humanoid models in ways that kind of bring out these draconic features. And so I think that that notion of sort of the mutability of blight, this sort of, it's almost like a controlled cancer is sort of how I think of kind of the Legion aesthetic, is that it's both biological engineering and also this sort of like mutated dragon army. And there's some aspects of Everblight that I think are just really interesting that play into that too, which is the notion of this, a creature that is both very powerful, but also vulnerable to destruction and has had to adapt very rapidly just to exist. You know, I think with the Legion more than any other faction, you have this sense that they're constantly in a desperate fight for survival in a different way than is, I think, the case with the other factions, because they kind of sprang from nowhere. And there's several groups that are very dedicated to trying to stamp them out in a very, you know, directed way. You know, even though the Trollkin are also a faction that we show being focused on survival, you know, the truth is there's no one really trying to just like wipe out all the Trollkin. You know, they've had a really rough time of things. And they certainly had more than their share of bad luck, but there are powerful agencies in the world that would like nothing more than just erase Everblight and everything he's done. And yeah. So there's this that fuels this sort of desperate need to grow and to fight and move and, you know, and adapt.
I was just going to say, I feel like the community has also really embraced that idea.
Yeah. In what way do you think?
Yeah,
the fear that they're going to be wiped out.
Yeah, there's a love of hating Legion. I think unites in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Yeah, I do think, you know, there's times, and I can understand why, you know, with as many factions as we have now, there's times where any given faction might feel on the outs, or that, you know, maybe they haven't been getting the attention recently that they wish. You know, it's always unfortunate when that happens, but you know, every faction feels neglected to one degree or another, you know, other than whatever got the most recent goodies.
Yeah, someone had asked specifically about Lanissa's hatred for Everblight, so maybe that's a good segue into that.
Why is she so mad?
Well, cousins or something? Or am I thinking of the other one?
I don't recall very specifically her motivations aside from just the general. I think that a bunch of her friends died to the Legion, but like, you know, anybody who is not blighted and is Nis is probably not too happy with the Legion in general. And, you know, that's something we've explored with a couple of the non-blighted Nis, you know, that are serving as mercenaries or minions, is the notion that, you know, they want to kind of get some payback for the fact that their entire culture was basically wiped out. Like, you know, there's two different ways you can look at that. Like, if you're in the Legion, they've evolved, they've changed, they've become something new, you know, something different. But if you're not a blightedness, you know, there's no way to look at the arrival of Thagrosh and Vale's betrayals anything but just like the worst catastrophe ever, where all of their tribes were, you know, subsumed by this alien horror, and, you know, those that managed to survive desperately ran away and tried to find shelter elsewhere and have been trying to recover from that. And
what cowards.
You know, desperately managed to or tried to save their god, all the while Gorshade's trying to get a hold of them. So, you know, they've had some rough years, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, I'm a little hazy on, I haven't looked closely at Lanissa recently, and I can't remember what all details we've explored, but I do think there were some specific casualties to people that she cared about that was related to that.
If she's got problems, she can come and talk it out. We'll be happy to meet with her. It's fine.
Sure, yeah. Here, drink, you know.
Like, look, just sit down with Thagrosh for a couple of minutes. You'll be fine.
That's
the worst that could happen.
Yeah, if you were to just stick a thank shard into someone, how much control do they have over kind of being assimilated?
I think that in general, they would not have control. We also haven't shown that, which I do think is kind of interesting. Like, so far, it seems as though Everblight has not used the transformation of somebody into a warlock as a weapon. So maybe there are limits. Like, maybe those that didn't respond to his blight might resist, or maybe it would be painful, or like maybe they you know, maybe there's a way they could reject it. I've always imagined that basically, you know, if you put an authink in somebody, you'd probably enable Everblight to take them over, but maybe that doesn't mean that they would be able to undergo that full transformation into a warlock.
Didn't Lilith have a bad time taking it out?
Yeah, Lilith, we showed, I think that was in, was that in Metamorphosis? Or no, maybe it was in Evolution. It was right around the time when the fight in the Castle of Keys was going on, because Lilith was actually sort of the first scout in to evaluate the situation with Pyromalphic. And she, you know, got discovered, and some of the cultists managed to kind of wound her. And so there was a situation there where it seemed like she might perish and that they would need to basically come pick up her authank. And I think we actually did, yeah, we had her remove it. And that was a fun piece of fiction to write, where you could kind of see Lilith's mind returning a little bit, you know, to its pre-blighted state, and, you know, definitely caused some conflict and some emotional turmoil until, you know, it was inserted back in again. There, you know, it's, you can imagine it as sort of the mind washing slipping a little bit with Everblight. But she was, you know, expecting that she would be basically abandoned and given up. But the twins showed up and were able to restore her offhand back to where it belonged. You know, Lilith's a real interesting character, because she's a character who was kind of emotionally broken even before she joined the Legion. Like she was already sort of a psychopathic murderer. against the Kedorans, who had killed her father. And so she was already in kind of a weird place even before she got taken over by the dragon.
And to be fair, Kedor deserves it.
yeah. But anyway, yeah, like, I think Lilith's kind of interesting, because she, you know, was already sort of the ultimate killer even before she got brought into the, you know, it was fun in that story to kind of explore what it would be like for her to lose her authentic. And we've kind of seen her bit of a martyr complex a couple of times, where, you know, when the first Gargantuans respond, you know, she was willing to give up her life to try to intercept, you know, a dragon that was threatening Everblight.
Since you brought up the twins, I do have a question, and I don't know, sure, if you can really say anything on it, so feel free to completely dodge this one if you have to.
Sure.
But ever since Wrath of the Dragonfather, it seems like, you know, at the end of that, they were kind of running away going, look, we kind of know we messed up a little bit here, and Everblight seems a little upset, so we're not going to show back up and end up dead. You know, since then, there's been some communication, I guess, where the other warlocks are like, look, he's calmed down, you're fine, come back, you're good.
Yeah.
And they don't really seem to buy that.
We promise we won't eat you.
Yeah, we definitely left the twins in a weird state. I've always loved the notion that Saren in particular had a sort of a special relationship with the Authink, where she was able to kind of keep her mind intact, where, you know, she's kind of had it in her back pocket that if she needed to, she could ignore Everblight, that she could do what she wants. And so she was still part of the sort of the mental network and working with everybody else, but she basically wasn't mind controlled in the same way that everybody else was. Like, you know, Everblight could try to put the brakes on what she was doing, but she felt like she had a way out of it. And we kind of, that was something that we explored a little bit in the fiction there for a little while, where she was kind of, as I say, kind of keeping that in her back pocket. And it wasn't until Wrath of the Dragonfather where that kind of came to the fore, where basically, you know, there was a tough situation where, from Everblight's POV, you know, I do think he calmed down on it a little bit later, but the notion is, you could look at it from one point of view that Saren allowed an Authink to escape her grasp that Everblight could have eaten, that would have made him more powerful, that could have helped preserve him. From Saren's perspective, the agreement that she entered into with Haley, this reluctant sort of agreement at the end of Wrath of the Dragonfather, it was done to preserve Everblight. And so, you know, it's one of those things where basically, like, the thing he wanted most could have destroyed him. And so, you know, she made the decision to surrender the Authink to a third party. And, you know, so I think there's a part of Everblight that finds that very hard to accept. You know, he's like, there had to be a way for me to get that thing. And basically, it's, you could imagine it as sort of a chain of command problem, where Saren and Ryas exceeded their authority in ignoring Everblight's commands. And so that kind of put them on the outs with Everblight. But we did suggest that, you know, in the time that has passed, since Wrath of the Dragonfather, we had a little bit of a time jump with the new edition that came out, that maybe the situation has calmed down and that they're trying to kind of bring the twins back into the fold, but there remains some distance there, that the twins are kind of wary of rejoining the rest of the Legion, at least in full. And that's kind of, you know, we sort of left things a little bit uncertain.
Yeah, given the dynamic that seems to be reflected both from Torok splitting the Athank apart, and then mm-hmm. also Everblight splitting into shards, and then the re-consuming of those does seem a little concerning. I could see why they might be a little reluctant about that.
Well, and also because you have to imagine, I mean, they, like Saren in particular, you know, she knows Everblight, and she has to think that he's not going to be okay with the fact that he can't control her. And so, you know, you have one of those things where you're, okay, so he's acting nice, but, you know, can I really trust him? You know, will he allow me to have my autonomy? And that's kind of what it comes down to, is whether Everblight can allow one of his warlocks to be outside his control.
Yeah, I can see kind of like the idea of a crocodile smile. I imagine a mm-hmm. dragon smile is a bit more unsettling.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
No, yeah, fine. Just come home. Let's see. Yeah. I forgive you.
I would never trust Everblight when he's putting on his nice guy hat, because I can't imagine he does a very good job. He's used to talking in that really loud, shouty voice. And you know, when he's being nice, and yeah, I don't know. It's just I would definitely be suspicious of it.
Everblight definitely uses the royal we.
Yes,
the Everblight version of governance. Look, I swear nothing bad is going to happen.
Yeah.
So we're nearing an hour there, Doug.
Yeah, that's true.
Why don't we do another couple questions, and sure. then we'll close up for this evening.
How's that? Sounds good.
All right, cool. Wolf, do you have any specific questions you want to ask?
Well, I mean, there was one I was kind of curious about. It was Castle of the Keys and then End of Wrath of the Dragonfather. It showed the warlocks and various other minions, Nisk, whoever, carving up the remains of Pyro Malefic for Castle of the Keys. And I want to say Charsog was the one that got eaten.
Yeah, poor. I think it was Charsog.
Yeah, that they were, you know, cutting off pieces of dragon and taking them back to throw in the spawning vessels. Is there anything... like, does that make a stronger beast to use actual dragon parts? Or does that, like, an experimentation thing of, okay, well, I've got these bones, therefore I can make bigger and better things now?
One of the things we established with, you know, the first sort of gargantuan spawning is the notion that it may require a piece of a dragon to create the gargantuan. And so we showed the use of dragon bones, you know, in that first spawning. And so I think the notion would be something like that. I didn't necessarily, or Zach, who I was working with on, we didn't necessarily have a specific thing in mind, but the notion would be the pieces of the dragon are super useful as concentrated, blighted elements that Everblight could make use of sort of in his, you know, biological forge. And so, you know, as new types of gargantuans or other unusual things might appear, that could be a result of having harvested, you know, the corpse of a dragon.
Yeah, that could be a pretty serious tell also if you see a new gargantuan and the rest of the world is thinking, okay, that came from somewhere. That's yeah. potentially disturbing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, kind of makes you wonder if the other dragons have figured that out yet. Like, huh, he's going to eat us and then he's going to turn our bodies into smaller...
Well, yeah. That was sort of the whole crux of what we had going on with Kruger's alliance with Blightergast, was the notion that it was a notion that Kruger had of, you know, he went to Blightergast to basically narc on Everblight and be like, how you used to have a friend in your alliance named Pyromalphic, well, he'd got eaten. And you guys might want to do something about that. So the whole arrangement that was happening there, where Kruger was kind of doing some sort of sneaky business kind of behind the backs of his peers, had to do with trying to find a way to eliminate Everblight by sort of finding out where all his warlocks were and having the dragons, the other sort of an aspect of the Wrath of the Dragonfather plot as it unfolded, is that it kind of got stymied by the appearance of this Athank that was unrelated you know, the one that with it, the Crixians were trying to get back to Torak, and that Signar accidentally picked up and they didn't know what it was. And so there was sort of this loose Aw-Thank that was in this containment thing. And so Charsog was the dragon that basically kind of got wind of that and sort of disobeyed the plan, where everybody was, you know, everybody was supposed to go hunting down the Legion warlocks, but he's like, hey, I could have that little snack first. and that kind of threw everything off. But yeah, the notion is that the dragons, they know that Everblight has eaten one of their own. We kind of set it up to where maybe there's sort of a truce right now, but I don't think anybody's very comfortable with it. You know, Everblight was like, no, you know, that was just a thing. I'm fine now. I don't intend to eat any of you guys. Everything's good. And I don't expect anybody takes his word for that.
Again, that Everblight governance of, trust me, what's the worst?
Yeah. Everblight's still working. He's still working on, you know, his sort of persuasion skills. It's definitely something he hasn't had to use as much as certain other abilities.
He's to level up his diplomacy.
Yeah, his diplomacy is sometimes a little lax.
He's got to roll that crit.
Just have to eat the correct dragon. Diplomacy.
Yeah, exactly. He's a little more of a scientist than a politician. So,
all right, Cutter, you got another question you want to ask, and then we'll wrap this thing up.
Sure. Yeah, I wanted to know. So, aside from Thagrosh, and then Kallus, who is kind of a construct.
We didn't get a chance to talk to him about him very much.
Yeah, if you wanted to discuss a little bit about, so all of Everblight's warlocks are female aside from Thagrosh and Kallus, and if you wanted to say anything specifically about that and maybe what's kind of unique about Kallus. And I know someone had asked something about Animag also, because she has some unique qualities as far as the warlocks go.
Right. You know, it's kind of one of those interesting areas. You know, you're talking about sort of taking the look at the creative process and you know, how I enter into it. There's times where my job, I feel like, is sometimes to try to come up with explanations or a backdrop for decisions that might be made that really had nothing to do with sort of the background of the material. You know, I think that originally the notion of it being Thagrosh and then mostly female Mist Warlocks was, again, just one of those faction aesthetic elements. You know, it was an area that Matt thought was interesting to explore, the notion that this would be a mostly female warlock faction, but where Thagrosh was sort of the exception to that. And from my perspective, we've never given like an exact reason why that is, but I do think it probably has to do with something to do with Thagrosh's part of the equation. Like, I think, I don't think that Everblight cares about gender at all, but I think it could be that there was just something with Thagrosh where when he was looking for champions among the Nis, he seemed to be a little bit more prejudiced toward women than men. And it could be that he didn't, you know, I don't even know if it was a conscious thing. Maybe he didn't want to have a male rival. It could just be that the warriors that were impressing the most were the women among the Nis. You know, it's one of those things where I think that the reason why they were female is more from Thagrosh than Everblight. But so long as Everblight was getting the sort of the generals that he needed, it just sort of didn't matter to him. He's like, okay, whatever. You know, you can pick the next champion that you think is cool. I don't really care one way or the other. And yeah, with Kallus, we have the notion of a sort of experiment where Everblight wanted to try to basically create an artificial entity, taking one of his Aw-Thank shards and instead of inserting it into a person, changing it to where it becomes sort of a template for a new warlock. And so basically Kallus is an entirely artificial warlock, which I think is really, you know, kind of interesting. And I don't think that Kallus takes on a male form, again, probably because Thagrosh was sort of creating almost like an heir, creating sort of a, you know, almost like a son. But I don't think that Kallus is actually male either. I think that Kallus is basically, again, sort of a draconic neutral that just happens to sort of have a male appearance, again, probably from Thagrosh's, you know, creation of him. And but yeah, it's kind of interesting. The thing I liked the most with the creation of Kallus was the notion of killing him off and right when we introduced him to kind of show that he could reform himself, you know, from anything. And yeah. that was a real fun little story arc to play with.
He just needs like a vessel, right?
Yeah. got the little mini authInk shard and sent it back to the lab, and some poor Scorn, Mortithurge back at HQ happened to be nearby and basically became Callus, as the meat that became Callus. So he can basically transform, you know, any living matter back into himself. And then during the dragon war, we had the situation where Callus actually got swallowed by one of the dragons and almost digested, but his power was such that he was able to sort of maintain some coherence and kind of fight his way out from the inside, like basically carved his way out of the dragon and became his new form, because like in the intensity of the blight, it's like you can almost imagine it like the template of his being that was sort of inscribed in the authInk changed in the course of almost being digested by a dragon. So Callus has basically survived, something that no other creature has ever survived, being eaten by a dragon.
I have to imagine Everblight was extremely interested in that process.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's got to be kind of impressive. Like, hey, yeah, you got swallowed, and yet you're still here.
That's
pretty
good.
We're definitely going to look into this when we have a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
Not right now.
But well, and I do think there is a drawback too, which I think Everblight is like, we've shown that is not the way that he has necessarily gone forward. And I think a lot of the other warlocks were worried about that. When Callus was first created, the idea with the other warlocks was probably like, is this the new thing that's going to replace us? You know, is this how Everblight's going to do it from now on? But I think that when you get down to it, that piece that is Callus is no longer Everblight. So basically Everblight had to give up a portion of himself to create Callus. And I think he probably decided, you know what, I'm already divided pretty heavily here. I don't think I want to give up another piece of myself. And so we haven't seen him do that again. Not that he couldn't, but I think that there is a cost involved in that Everblight would have to kind of give up a piece of himself to create another Callus.
Awesome.
That makes sense. I do actually have one more question if we have time.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
No, I don't mind.
So we got Animag most recently. But
oh, yeah.
I don't remember seeing anything in the fluff that like she had an Anthank shard, like that he was part of it at all. It just kind of, she just came up and was like, hey, this giant bird follows me around and you're all going to listen to me now.
Yeah, in my opinion, there's definitely an Authank in Animag, because I don't think you can be a warlock in the Legion and create dragon spawn without having an Authank. But I do think that Animag's relationship to Everblight and to the Legion is different. And she's a really interesting character that I'm kind of looking forward to maybe exploring a little bit more at some point, because you kind of get the sense that she was already a mystic. She was already something kind of unprecedented among the Ogryn. We've shown that they basically can't do magic normally. Like the so far, the only way we've shown Ogryn doing magic is to get an Authank. And it seems like Animag had some kind of mystical powers even before becoming a part of the Legion. And so she's definitely has her own thing going on, her own sort of strange, you know, rotted meat magic or something that's happening. And so I think that she's kind of a unique asset, where I think that she does have an Authank, but it might be a particularly small piece. And I don't think that as much of her power is rooted in the Authank as it is for the other world. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of variable between them too. Like, we know Vale was our sorceress even before she got the Authank, but clearly it's almost like she switched power sources. You know, once she became a warlock, now her power is more blight driven. I think that Animag has kind of her own thing going on, but I do think she has an Authank.
That's cool. That's good to know. All right. So, final and most important question I could ever think of, and I think this has gotten brought up before on the old Primecast, but we need a definitive answer, Doug. Are you ready?
Sure.
Do dragons poop?
No, they do not.
All right. So, everybody, that's the most important question. You can go home now. We're good here.
They can transform matter to energy, so no need to poop.
Oh, man. That's sweet.
It like is.
Giant nuclear reactors.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Doug. Thank you so, so much for joining us on the show.
This has been fun. This has been really cool.
Before we let you go, I would like to know if you have anything coming up that you would like to plug.
Nothing too. There's a CCAT collection of short stories that's going to be out in the near future. I'm not sure exactly when. There is some stuff in there that I think you guys would enjoy.
Fantastic. Are you going to be at War Machine Weekend?
I do not think I'm going to be at War Machine Weekend.
Yeah, that's a shame. So, no, that's fine. I just thought maybe we could send some blighted legion towards you.
I really enjoy War Machine Weekend, but I don't think I'm slated for that. this time.
Fair enough. All right, Cutter, Wolf, anything you guys want to leave on?
Poker Brawl, still looking for people. Sign up, I dare you. Other than that, I think that's about it.
Well, and I hope my sound wasn't cutting out too badly.
No, it was mostly good. Cutter?
All right.
Yeah, I'm all set. Just want to extend my thanks to Doug and also to John and to Pagani and Hungerford, who kind of all helped pull strings to make this happen. We're really grateful. I think the Legion community will really enjoy it. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Yeah, looking forward to doing it again.
Awesome. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening to episode 12 of Blightbringers.
Take care, everybody.
How have we been doing this for 3 months?
All right, guys. Take care.
Thanks, Doug.
Bye.